visual expert is at summer camp, so that's why we're struggling here. That would be Reed. All right. Can I go to the map first?
Yes, that's right down here.
All right, great. All right.
Once you want to, not yet, but as soon as you click on this, I'll do that.
Okay, great.
Get to it, and then you can click on.
First, I had to put a map to get everybody oriented because that's the only way I can stay oriented. So I'm very low tech. So we flew into San Jose and then took a bus all the way down to this itty bitty little spot right there. So now we can go on to the pictures. That's just my big intro there. All right. So there's a lot of prayer.
All you have to do is press this one to go forward, that to go back, and that to point with a little light.
Oh, neat. You mean I could have used that?
Of course, the point light's not that good.
All right.
Okay.
So a lot of prayer, a lot of preparation goes into these trips, and this trip was certainly no different. It was probably over a year in the planning. And then I sent out that kind of desperate need for medical equipment, everything back in October so we could get the equipment for this trip. And so just things kind of go on. Seems like the closer I get to the departure date, the faster my praying gets, the rhythm kind of picks up until finally I leave. And then it kind of slows down while I'm in the air, and then when I land, it starts picking up again because we got to get a bunch of drugs and things through customs, and so it gets more and more staccato as I get closer to the customs area. So Deborah May was one of the girls, one of the nurses that brought in the meds for us, and so I'm standing back there just praying. We're all praying like crazy that the meds get in, and they certainly do. They pass right through, so I'm ready to glide through customs thinking, you know, we've got it made. And then I get yanked to the side because my bags are going to get searched. I've got all these backpacks in my big bag. There's 15 backpacks in there, and I guess it looks like a bunch of knives or something. I don't know, because of the slats in the packs. So they pull me over to the shakedown table, and they start screaming at me in Spanish, and I don't know what they're saying. And the only thing I could think of to say to them was, these are gifts from my friends. And I guess they had to make a big show of it, because they kind of, you know, shook me down for a few minutes and then just kind of waved me through with this smirk, you know, like, okay, go on. You know. So the next morning, we got on in a bus after loading, and it was about 9 hours to the Panamanian border. And then you go through another shakedown process on the border, so lots of prayers and everything's going, and just delays. And I don't really understand how this all works. It's just like you have to wait a certain amount of time, and then they let the gringos through. I don't get it. But so we waited on the border. We get through, and then we have to go. If you remember on that map, that little itty-bitty peninsula, we have to cross into Panama, do this kind of big U-turn, and then come back in through Costa Rica. And that's where we hit the trailhead. Otherwise, we have to come down the coast, and it takes literally 24 hours to do that. And we didn't want to do that with horses and supplies and all that kind of stuff. We didn't want to kill anybody on the way in. We'll save that for later. So we finally get to the trailhead, and it looks kind of like this, which is just a gravel road. And we got there really late because it took us so long to get through customs. So it's like, you know, 4:30 in the afternoon, and it gets dark really fast in the jungle. So they scrounged up this old four-wheel drive pickup truck that looked like it was on its last leg, and they loaded all of our gear into that. Backpacks, food, medical supplies, everything except just the little stuff that we have. And they took it to the little trailhead. So this was about, I don't know, 4 miles or so, kind of going up and down like that. And some of the people were having a pretty hard time with this. I was wondering, you know, it's going to get rough later on. I just don't know how everybody's going to fare. So when we get to the trailhead, they had 5 horses to load all the gear on, and then they were going to take it to the camp for us, and we would just be responsible for taking our backpacks in. Well, in their expedience, they took all the pertinent gear, and then they took a lot of the backpacks too. So for some of us like myself that had budgeted my water, and the little water that I had was going to last me until I got to my backpack, which had 3 liters, it was gone. My son's backpack was gone, and several people's backpacks were gone. So we're like, oh, I don't know how far we got to go, but we got to drive on with no water, essentially. So I was kind of with the first group. There were 2 Costa Rican women, 1 Costa Rican man, myself and Reed, and this 13-year-old boy from the village that was going to lead us in. So we just strapped on random packs and just headed up the trail. And by now, it's nightfall. So it's just like somebody turns out the lights there. You know, one minute it's like you can see, and the next minute it's dark. But luckily, it was a three-quarters moon, so we could, you know, still navigate the trail reasonably well. Until I, you know, did a couple almost somersaults that I had. I don't know why I brought this teeny weeny little light. So when the trail started getting rough, I turned this light on, kind of walking around like a blind man trying to find my way up the trail. So we struggle on, and we did. I thought we did reasonably well. Again, it was about 4 or 5 miles, kind of up and down, and just kind of really pretty rugged. So we got in at about 9 or 9:30, I'm guessing. And so groups start trickling in knots, you know, 6 to 8 people at a time. And by about 10 o'clock, the women had been cooking all day, so they wanted to serve us this big meal, you know, welcome and all this stuff. And so I sit down, and I literally get my second bite of food in my mouth, and Marconi comes running out. Marconi's kind of second in command Operation Mobilization Costa Rica. He comes running up, and he goes, Dr. Klint. I'm like, what? You know, what's going on? So he gives me the radio, and on the other end is Brantley. And Brantley sounds like he is just, I've never heard him sound so tired and distressed in his whole life. Brantley's the head of the evangelism part of the trip. And he says, Klint, Kevin says he's in diabetic ketoacidosis. And I'm going, ketoacidosis. I remember that word when I was in medical school. That was a long time ago. So I'm thinking, ask Kevin what he needs to do. And so I go, all right, ask Kevin what he needs me to do, because I have no idea. You know, so he says he needs his medical kit, because all of his insulin and all of his supplies went up the trail without him. So I said, okay, fine, I'll get that. So I grab that, and I grab a liter of juice, and I start running down the trail with a couple of the village kids. And about a half mile down, we run into these two people with horses. And I guess everybody knows everybody, so there was some negotiating going on. And we got used to these horses. So one of the older boys gets on a horse, and he wants me to get on a horse. And I'm like, no, thank you. Thank you very much. So I give him the medical supplies and the juice. And I said, just go find them on the trail. Give them the stuff. They'll know what to do with it. So, and then I get a second kid. I said, follow him with this horse, because we may need it. You just never know. And then with the third kid, I went, you know, running up the trail after him. So when I get there, Kevin sprawled out and Brantley sprawled out. And Kevin says, my sugar's 400. And that's like over twice normal. And I'm going, man, that's pretty bad. You're still talking to me? He said, at this point, he said, I'm so dehydrated that I got to get an IV in to open up my blood vessels so that we can get the insulin going. I'm like, okay, great. So we'll pack you on a horse and we'll get you back. So I knew Kevin was going to be okay when I get him on the horse, and he says, here's my camera, take a picture. I was like, take a picture? He says, take a picture. He said, the guys in the emergency room aren't going to believe I got medevaced on a horse. So we get him packed up and get him down the trail, and then it's time to get Brantley on a horse. And he is so spent, he's physically exhausted and cannot get on the horse. You know, Brantley leans on the horse, and then the horse starting to lean on Brantley. I'm like, man, this is not going to be a good situation. So the village people had this great idea to kind of maneuver the horse down into a rut. So he does, so that Brantley just kind of has to step over and sit down. And that worked out pretty good. So we got Brantley off the trail. So I kind of followed him in, and then when I got there, you know, Kevin was looking good. He had an IV running, he had fluids in, he had sugars. Everything was kind of balancing out and looking normal. So that was our introduction to going into the jungle. Let's see, that's just kind of a looking off the trail, looking down over. So we kind of hooked around to the right and circled back down into the left, kind of heading down into this valley area. Oh, this was the Las Penitas traffic jam. On the other end of that rope was this bull that was about as, you know, 4 times the size of this table. Just whenever it wanted to, it would just kind of lay down in the road. And they would kick it and get it going. It would go another 100 yards and it would lay down again. So this is an area where there was the bull was kind of in a ditch, and then so we got up in the high spot and zipped around him so we wouldn't be delayed any further. There's Brantley the next morning after, got his coffee there, getting him pumped back up. That's our kitchen. They prepared all the food in this. When I loaded them onto this memory stick, they kind of got all jumbled and out of order, and I apologize, so I'll just kind of go through as I can. This is kitchen table, complete with chickens and dogs running in between your legs. There was a lot less chickens when we left. This was supposed to be towards the end, but this is kind of the typical garb, which I thought was really cool. That little lady, she looks like she's a little plump lady, but she's not. She's about 92 pounds. The dresses are just big and flowy, and they're just very cool, and they wear them for everything. But most of them are handmade. Some of them are made with a sewing machine, but she had made those by hand, and they're just beautiful. So I had, of course, had to get a picture. This is George. George Chen is the medical student from UCLA, and when the prayers were going up, you know, we needed people really bad. And Pat Raley called up, who's head of OM Medical Missions, and he said, Clint, I've got this medical student. Do you think he'd be any use? And I said, what year is he? He's a fourth year. I said, oh, man, he knows all the drugs and all that good stuff. Yeah, bring him along. He's golden. So we got George Chen, who was outstanding. He had just finished an acupuncture certification, so he did all this kind of stuff and treated people. You know, it's not like you got to give him pills and let him go. He was curing people right and left. It was really inspiring. I may have to pick up on some of that. This is Ruben Castro's back. I don't have a front shot of him. It didn't get loaded. I apologize. But he's the doctor that we finally got just a few days before the trip that y'all were praying for. Ruben is a great guy. He's been out of school 3 years and is getting ready to go into his interventional radiology fellowship. I'm like, what the heck is he doing on a mission trip out in the sticks? Well, he and Alex Paniagua, who's head of OM Costa Rica, have been childhood friends, and he just mentioned in passing, said, you know, we really need a doctor for this trip. And he says, I'll go. I've always wanted to do this. I'll go. Why didn't you tell me sooner? These are, let's see, in the foreground is one of our cooks, Marconi's wife, and then back there is Eber, who was one of the kids with me that night. He is the pastor's son, and just he is really a really bright kid. He speaks Spanish. He speaks French. He knows some of the Indian dialects, and he's studying English right now. Really bright kid. We're hoping that maybe he can be the next pastor coming up.
Is he the one with the teeth or the other kid?
He's the one with the teeth. Yeah, he's getting ready to make this grimace like he has a mouthful of rotten teeth. That's what he was doing there. And this is Mariana on the left. She's from El Salvador and will let you know it every chance she gets. And this is Yamilet on the right. They're doing the kind of the dental hygiene thing there. This is just a little kid blazing through the village. I got a shot of one night. Little sweet pea. Oh, that's the final approach of the trail coming up. I got that the morning after the trail of death or tears maybe. This is camp. These are the tents that y'all helped or that y'all furnished for everybody. It's looking like Tent City there. This is our mobile pharmacy concept. When we were in the jungle last year, we needed, you know, because you got to set up in the middle of nowhere and you've got nothing to work with. So we needed something to hold our drugs and keep them off the ground. And we looked at all this really high speed, you know, very expensive special forces gear and everything. And I went to Target one day. I'm looking through there. I go, hey, $7 a piece? That'll work. So there we go. That's our mobile pharmacy. And of course, they stole it from me and they took it out on the next trip. Another sweet pea from the village. That is Wilson. He's a 13-year-old kid that Reed has renamed the Beast because that night he let us in, he strapped on one of those big old backpacks and just motored up and down the hills like it was nothing. You see those high-speed hiking shoes he has on, they barely fit him. He's like two sizes too small. That's the inside of the kitchen. They prepared everything in there. You could not believe it. The stove is actually sitting. They cook the food in this wooden box. It defies my logic because it's like, why don't you set this whole place on fire? But they were able to smoke food and fry things and cook and just go at it. That is a mango tree. I never knew where mangoes came from, you know. So I always thought they came from bushes. But 37 years ago, Pastor Vasquez bought this property and started his kind of homestead there. 35 years ago, a traveling vendor came through with mangoes and sold him a bushel of mangoes, and he ate one and planted the seeds, and this is a tree. So the kids there, they eat them like apples. When they're about the size of an apple, they just pick them off the tree, and they sprinkle salt on them, and down they go. I was like, yuck, but they liked them. That's the gringo tent area there. We all slept in hammocks off the ground. Again, this is kind of out of order. Let me go back up one. Oops. Okay, so typical morning would be the sun rises at like 4, and the howler monkeys start at 4:30. And if you've never heard a howler monkey, it's very prehistoric. And when you hear one, you're like, what the heck was that? Anyway, so you get used to it, and then you kind of like it, you know. So 4:30, the howler monkeys start, and then at 5 o'clock, the cacophony of prayer starts going up because the prayer warriors get up, and they walk around the village all morning long back and forth. So you're like, can't beat them, I'll join them. So I just, every morning I would get up, and I'd go out there and just pray with them for about a half an hour. It was really, really cool. You just kind of pray back and forth, and you're watching the sunshine, and then
can you tell them what a howler monkey sounds like?
No.
Just...
Yeah, if you want to, it's a very unique. That's not well, sort of. But let's see, train of thought here. Okay, so after we do the prayer, everybody says their prayers, and the ones that like coffee go to the kitchen and get your coffee there, and then you sit down with your Bible and you read, and you're getting dive bombed by these parrots. There's like a trillion variety of parrots in Costa Rica, and they've got these big giant ones that fly over, like they look like geese, and then they've got the small ones that just kind of whip around through you. It's just a really unique experience. So when we went to Peru last time, we took an optometrist with us. And that was the coolest thing I've ever seen, because he brought one style of glasses, and he had glass that he could flip back and forth or do what. Anyway, he could make glasses for people. And I thought, it was so life-changing. They go from not being able to see to being able to see. And I thought, that is just so cool. Well, I can't do that, but I can buy reading glasses, which is what we did. We bought 20 pairs of reading glasses for about $1.50 a piece. And putting a guy like this into a pair of reading glasses where he can see his hands for the first time in like 20 years is really cool. He can read. He can, you know, mend his nets. He can do all kind of stuff. That was really cool. I love these instant cure kind of things. I'm really into that instant gratification kind of thing. This is Susana. She was about 2 months away from being a dentist. This trip was, I don't want to say littered, but full of just super rich characters or people, just really great people. We didn't know she was a dentist. We just kind of had to pick that out of there. She came to be an interpreter. That's all she was going to do. But it's like every time that they were short, you know, something like, oh, God, can anybody play the guitar? Susanna could play the guitar. Can anybody sing and play the guitar? She could play and sing the guitar. I mean, she could do everything. She had a fantastic voice. She was in drama. She did everything. She extracted a tooth with a Leatherman tool. She was the bomb. I couldn't believe this lady. So here she's teaching this girl how to do dental hygiene with just stuff like cloth. You can take the cloth and wipe your teeth, and then you can unthread the cloth and use it for dental floss and clean in between. It was just, she was great. This is Deborah May on the left, pediatric emergency room nurse. Anne Laurie May from South Africa. She just happened to be in Costa Rica on an Operation Mobilization AIDS outreach. She found out, because she's friends with Alex and Julie Paniagua, the heads of Costa Rica OM, and she said, oh, we're going to the jungle in a few weeks to go and be with these indigenous peoples. And she says, oh, really? Hey, can I go? And they said, well, we'll ask Clint. And I said, sure. So Ann came along, and she was just fantastic. And Susan Hunter is another nurse on the right-hand side. She's from Atlanta as well. There's my son. So that's not a really great representation of the jungle, but it is thick. I mean, you just can't believe how thick it is, and the trees are enormous. I mean, if you want to get an idea, look at Jurassic Park. It's the same thing. I mean, it's just it's something to behold. I don't know who this guy is on the right, but the guy on the left got a new pair of glasses, and he was another guy squinting at the camera. Of course, as soon as he got his glasses, he was just so protective of them because he didn't want them to get ruined or anything. Oh, I forgot their names. Sylvia and I can't remember, but two sisters. They're just sweet peas running around. This is Andres, my interpreter. And usually on trips, everybody that goes is a Christian. Well, we were short of interpreters. And Andres is not a Christian, but he's Alex's cousin. And I didn't know he wasn't a Christian until like day one. You know, things are a little bit slow and we're talking. And the reason they brought him along is because he's good with English. He's, by profession, he's a tour guide, raft guide, and all that kind of stuff. So he's good with, you know, people. So I found out he wasn't a Christian. Then we had several very long talks. And, of course, we prayed over him one morning and with the rest of the Americans. And so every day somebody would get Andres and take him, talk to him, and kind of give him the word. And so on the last night that we were there, I said, Andres, I'm not gonna lecture you anything. All I'm gonna tell you is I love you and I want to see you in heaven with me, so please make the right choice. So of course he starts crying and killing me. Another local people there. I had a couple of big families like this. These guys all had kind of funguses and just assortment of things. And Reed took my picture there while I was suffering away trying to figure out what to do with these poor people. The other ones I got them all sat down, and they all had chicken pox. So various stages of chicken pox. So I just, first thing I did is make sure everybody has had chicken pox that was in that room with me, and everybody had, so then we were okay. So we just treat them symptomatically and let them go. This is our clinic. The building on the left is where we saw all the folks, and that is their church. And Reed and I put up these tarps and things, and we needed these poles. You know, I mean, we needed something to hold the tents up. So the pastor walks out with a machete and whacks these couple of bamboo shoots up and brings them back for us, and there we go, instant tent. And on the right, where Linda is in the blue, that's our little pharmacy area. And next, this is our waiting room. So just behind those benches, it drops straight down about 300 feet and then kind of goes up into the valley next door, or next valley over. This is Pastor Vasquez. This is his church in his village, wearing two hats. Was his thing. Let's see. Lots of stories, but I'll try to keep it limited here. Kevin's the guy with diabetes is the guy in white. Linda Root is the, let's see if I can do this right, that's Linda Root. You know the tip of the spear, that whole story about the headhunters and whatnot? Well, her mom and dad were in the missionaries in Ecuador that were part of that mission down there. And they are the ones that had to get the five people that were killed out of there. She spent 17 years down in Ecuador as a mission kid and went to the United States to become a nurse, and now she's getting ready to head back into the mission field. So she was just a jewel to work with. She was absolutely wonderful. And Maria. Oops, I didn't mean to go that one. See, Maria is, that's Maria. This is the last big story I'm going to tell, then you can get rid of me. Brantley noticed that she had these, like, bruises on her arms and her knees, and so, of course, being Brantley, he inquires about it. And to make a very long story short, she and her husband started this fishing industry from a fishing shack and grew it into kind of an international business with 11 boats and, you know, the whole works. She comes home from work one day, and there's a note on the kitchen table, literally, "I left with the maid." So he kicks her out of the house. So she was not a Christian at that time. So she essentially was kicked out of the house, penniless, destitute. So she spent the next couple of years just praying, and she met some Christians, and she became a Christian. She spent two more years on her hands and knees, you know, praying for restitution and praying to restore her marriage and just whatever God would do for her. And the statute of limitations in Costa Rica is 2 years, and it had been about five, so she was really do nothing. So in this whole process of being kind of beat down, she just felt she had no worth. So she didn't think that she could do anything. But some of her Christian friends said, "You can. You can hire an attorney and, you know, at least get something out of it." So 4 days before she left for this trip, the estate, or whatever you call it, was settled. The estate was worth $17 million, for which she is entitled to half. So we were all out there with a millionaire. But she was so gracious, you never would have known that she had a penny. I mean, it was just a wonderful person. This is on the way out. This is kind of looking back over our shoulder where the fog is rising. That's the valley that we had just come out. And then beyond that is the Pacific Ocean. And when you live out there locally, this is how you bring your groceries home. So we met this woman. She was coming in from town, and we were heading on the way out. Made us feel bad. We were whining with one backpack on. This lady's carrying two. Yeah, with no shoes. So that's it. Anybody can be a missionary. You just got to strap it on and go. Anybody have any questions?
Is that very common, no shoes?
Yeah, everybody has feet that are about this wide. Yeah, yeah. Some do, but not many. But yeah, David? All different. I mean, what was neat about this is it was so far out there that the patients would come in and they would spend the day. I forgot to tell you about that. So the typical day, you know, after we saw patients, it would get dark early. So after dinner, when it was dark, the people would kind of line up in that one area with the tarps. They would set up, you know, a beamer, what they call the beamer. And so they would start off with prayers, and then they would do either music, or they would do a little drama or something like that, and then they would show a movie. And the movie was with indigenous people typically, and how their life was before they found Christ, or before Christ found them, and then afterwards. And then they would preach, so they would get some preaching for about 30 or 40 minutes of pretty hardcore preaching, and then everyone would just be kind of stunned silence, and then they would just kind of go home, or we'd pray with them, or just whatever. But that's kind of how the day went. Yes, sir.
Did they have a common religion before they arrived? Were they
evangelized
by another church?
There's a lot of Catholicism there, and they were kind of, the feel was kind of Episcopalian-y. You know, because it was, the preaching was loud, and it was, you know, repetitive kind of stuff, and it wasn't like you get out the Bible and, you know, go from the Word. On the final night, everybody kind of got put on the spot at one time or another. So the final night, we're all saying our goodbyes. The whole village is, you know, kind of crammed with people, and we're kind of in the back, and the kids come up and hug you, and what? And then the pastor comes up and says, "Can you say a few things to the villagers?" I'm like, "You ever had that moment where you're absolutely blank? There's not anything flying through your head?" Well, that was how I was for about 10 seconds. And then I finally, you know, kind of got my wits about me, and I said, "This is going to be simple. I mean, I'm going to tell you the same thing that I tell my kids, which is, at some point in your life, you know, whoever you esteem in your life, whether it be your mother, your father, or a president, or your best friend, or whomever, somebody's going to do something, and they're going to let you down. I said, but there's one person that's never going to let you down, and that's Jesus Christ. And the only way to get to know Jesus Christ is by reading your Bible every day, and I pray that you all can have access to a Bible so you can read it for yourself. Stunned silence. So, anyway, that's it. Thanks.